And I understand that, but.
Just thought I'd beat on you, so you thought.
But on rainy days like today.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. For this lovely March 24th. Third day of spring or something, we should be very. Comes roaring in like a lion. All right. We're going to open a couple of public hearings. Oh, for reference, we are not going to work any bills today, but we will take some invited testimony on House Bill 3276 toward the end of this session. But if you're here to see a bill pass or fail, it's not going to pass or fail. Which one did I mean? 2664. Sorry about that. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2408. And invite Representative Lively to join us. Following that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3276. Yes, one of our colleagues to join us in, too. Representative Lively.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm State Representative from House District 12, which is Springfield. Something I've learned this session I didn't know before is I'm going to start introducing legislation based on when the committee meets. So those committees that meet at 8 a.m. on Fridays, I probably won't have any legislation. I admire you for being
here. Some of us thank you.
If you don't introduce legislation, we probably won't have to meet then.
Well, that's right. I figured both of those are true. So I appreciate it. So I'm here today to encourage your support of House Bill 2408, which is creating the opportunity to expand the number of school-based health centers. I was recently in a public hearing, had to do with education, but not this specifically, with some other colleagues, and we were having this conversation, and one of my colleagues that's about the same age I am made a comment about, well, when I was in school. Now, what I recognize, when I was in school or others close to my age, it was very different than it is today, and what I hope all of us have learned over time, things have changed, and because things have changed and the challenges, we need to do things differently than we did it when I was in school. Only if it were as simple as it was when I was in school, but it's not. The challenges that the schools and the students in that face today are much greater. So it is clear the more we do to support students throughout their educational experience, the more likely they are to succeed and the need for less support throughout their lives. And so several of the members of this committee serve with me on the early childhood family supports, talking about the 0 to 5, and then we talk about education through. But we all know the evidence is clear. The more we can do early in their lives, the more successful they're going to be, and the less it's going to cost all of us after that point. Over the past 6 years, the legislature has recognized the value of school-based health centers and supported development of centers in more than schools, with approximately 79 operating today. The money invested by the legislature, which is about one-fifth of what it cost to run these centers, is small but a very important part to get the centers started and to sustain the centers. The centers are another example of what the collaboration and cooperation can do locally to leverage the amount of investment that the legislature makes to put these. And there's a lot of examples in different schools, public and private partnerships that create the opportunity for these centers to be successful. School-based health centers have been instrumental in addressing issues such as suicide, basic health concerns, taking on tough issues like bullying and drug and alcohol challenges. It wouldn't be nice if we didn't have to address those issues in schools, but we do. And if we want our schools to be successful, we need to give them the tools in which to address those issues and be successful. In the schools that have used these models, violence and bullying have been reduced by 55% or more. School-based health clinics provide access to affordable, high-quality physical, mental, oral, and preventive health services where our students are. So we're providing the services where the students are. In many cases, some of those students, they're at the school more than they are any other one location, in some cases more than home. As we continue to learn more about what impacts how successful our students might be, these clinics are a vital resource to implement best practices for those most impacted. A recent example of what we have learned about adverse childhood experiences, and we had just had in our committee the chance to talk about trauma and trained impacts, and that they have the and the adverse child experiences, the impacts they have on absenteeism and improving the graduation rate. The response to those adverse experiences is trauma-informed schools using new techniques and knowledge to recognize and address these impacts. School-based health clinics play an important role in implementing the strategies to combat the adverse experience. I fully appreciate and understand the budget cycle and the challenges that we find ourselves in this year. For me, though, it comes down to a matter of priorities and where we can make the most strategic investments that are going to help people be successful in the long term and diminish our costs at the other end of the cycle. I believe that school-based health centers is one example of those things that we can do more of and help more schools to have it. I look forward to working with you on this and similar efforts, which have been proving to produce the outcomes that save money and benefit us all in the long term. I would appreciate your consideration this, and I thank you for your time, even at 8 a.m. on Friday morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative. Sure. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Lively, I am really happy that you have this bill. When I worked for a nonprofit in Portland in my early years, when I came out of undergrad, one of my first jobs was to work for a nonprofit in a school-based setting. And I really appreciated the partnership that the school had with the school-based health center, because as a nonprofit, I went and worked with students. And we partnered to develop after-school programs, health education programs for parents and students, and that is so critical, particularly for particular families who otherwise would not get health access. That's and right. This was a way to do it, to build community, to get education, and to help parents and children understand that there was health access available in the school systems, which I thought was really critical. So thank you for bringing this bill to us.
Sure. I might also mention that other schools, there's schools doing a lot of other things to try to do pieces, as you've partly described. In my school district, I made a connection between the school district and one of the large clinics serving the Medicaid population. And the clinic, the doctors and nurses in that clinic are volunteering in some of the schools that don't have this. That's a tremendous advantage and value they're given to, and they're doing this volunteer work in order to make sure in some of those places where the kids don't have access that they're still getting some basic services. So there's a lot of ways, you're absolutely correct, working with other organizations in that to help try to do these things.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you, Representative John Lively from Lane County.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you here testifying before us. School-based health centers are a good plan because that's where kids are, right? So it's a good location that we can get health services provided to children that need those services. My question is not whether or not we ought to have school-based health centers, but the funding streams as we build this into the future. We have spent a lot of time setting up coordinated care organizations, working on 1115 waivers, which is the ability for Oregon to continue the Oregon Health Plan. Within the current waiver that's coming up for the next biennium, we have something that we've worked on that is a community benefit. There's a significant amount of dollars set aside for those community benefit dollars or to benefit communities, which I believe could be put in a coordinated effort to help fund school-based health clinics and other clinics throughout our communities. My concern with this, or my question is with this, as it starts to grow, teachers teach and run schools. Historically, they haven't run health clinics, right? And so are we actually going to start creating silos in the health center or the health system by setting up Department of Education-run health clinics and then coordinated care community benefit health clinics and not have as close a collaboration? I guess my question is, why aren't we working with the community benefit, the healthcare providers, to come into the schools that have that network already, rather than trying to build a larger network within the schools under the Department of Education?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden. I understand your concern and share this whole idea of not building silos. And certainly in the urban centers, we have more opportunities to do those collaborations and do those things you've talked about than we do in the rural. In many cases, the rural are going to be more dependent on what we can actually establish in the school. But I think the idea is to do exactly that. Again, I'll go back to my community. The investment that the CCO, Trillium, made in this family practice in Springfield that treats an enormous amount of Medicaid patients allowed the opportunity then for that family practice to work with the schools and to provide services in those schools that don't have health base. So I think there's absolutely a thing we keep to have to look to how do we make sure the linkages are there so we don't create the silos. But as you're well aware, certainly in rural parts of the state, it's going to be a tougher than it is going to be in the urban centers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think your point about early intervention is really important. It's one I understand. I grew up poor, and the first time I saw a dentist was when I was 15. And I've paid the price ever since and still continue to, and glad to see this happening.
Thank you, Chair. I'm excited to see this go forward. I reflect back on when I was a brand new public health nurse. I was involved in the very first school-based health center at Roosevelt High School in Portland. And the thing that I remember most from that was the overwhelming community response and all these people that flooded in. We had this little clinic that was going to do these few little things, and it was just absolutely overwhelming. So my comment is, as you move forward, particularly into a new community, be prepared for the onslaught.
That's a good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. It's an area I'm passionate about as well. And I appreciate Representative Hayden's comments. Would love to see CCOs more engaged. But one of the reasons that I'm very supportive of the school-based health clinics is because they are able to be reimbursed by whatever the payer is, whether it's Medicaid, OHP, or private insurance, which is a dilemma that I believe we still have. I see the chair of the co-chair of Ways and Means in the audience. I know this is an issue that she's been passionate about too, but I know it's been a dilemma up until now, at least, that the school nurses come out of the state school fund and have to compete with teaching dollars. So school-based health clinics have a great model in that they are able to collect reimbursement, and I encourage us to continue to get CCOs more involved and pick up some of those pieces other than the direct reimbursement that they pay, but I'm very supportive of this effort. Thank you.
Makes me think that in the financial situation we're in now, maybe keeping the funding there might be a win this year.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Keep up the good work at 8 a.m. on Friday.
One of the most important work is that when nobody can find us.
Thank you.
I know a lot of people seem to have found us.
Yeah, looks like they have. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3276 and ask Representative Nathanson to join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. In 2015, the University of Oregon campus in Eugene experienced a dangerous meningococcal disease outbreak, and now an outbreak has been identified at Oregon State University in Corvallis. This was not a one-time problem just in Eugene or at one campus, and we should be acting quickly to protect public health, minimize danger, and reduce costs to the public. The University of Oregon held vaccination clinics at the arena, the Student Recreation Center, and at several residence halls. Besides the UO, pharmacies, private clinics, and the Lane County Health Department also offered vaccinations. A report to the Legislative Fiscal Office details costs at LCC, Lane County Health Department, Oregon Health Authority, and the UO. At the UO, the outbreak happened during spring term. Many students did not have easy access to their primary care or in-network physician, and the university was then confronted with the problem of having to quickly vaccinate thousands of students. Thousands of other students and community members visited different health providers or local pharmacies. More than 30,000 doses of vaccine were administered in a quick period of time. Unfortunately, in many instances, the insurance companies refused to cover the vaccines, an unbudgeted financial burden accounting to $533,842 to the university alone. And you'll have numbers available for how much it also cost. The costs were to Lane Community College, Oregon Health Authority, Lane County Health Department, and so forth. One reason for refusing reimbursement was the insurer's requirement that vaccines be administered by a primary care or in-network physician. Cases of emergency like that at the UO or OSU require quick intervention. It's unreasonable to expect people, especially students, to travel, perhaps hundreds of miles or another state away, to visit their primary care physician or otherwise have quick access to an in-network physician. The most reasonable solution in an emergency situation is to allow people to obtain vaccination outside of their network or from a provider, even if not their own primary care physician, such as have a vaccination at the university's health center or a local pharmacy. Another reason for the lack of reimbursement was the status of the relatively new meningitis B vaccine. The FDA had approved the vaccine in 2014, but because it was so new, it didn't yet have the label of, quote, recommended, so that gave insurers a reason to deny coverage. So here's our solution. This bill allows people facing an emergency or urgent disease outbreak to get the vaccine they need when and where they need it and makes sure that the insurer will reimburse the cost. If the public health director identifies an urgent need to address a disease outbreak, epidemic, or other health condition, important health condition, the insurers must reimburse people enrolled in their plan for the cost of necessary pharmaceutical agents or measures, such as vaccines, to prevent the further spread of disease. The bill also makes sure that the insurer can't deny coverage just because the vaccine hasn't yet received that word recommended as a status, as long as it's approved. As long as the vaccine or other prophylactic measure is FDA approved, the insurer should cover it. And to improve response and reduce cost in the future, the bill directs the Oregon Health Authority to work with public universities and other key stakeholders to increase student health insurance coverage, review vaccination policies to prevent and address potential emergency situations, and to identify opportunities to minimize fragmentation of vaccine financing and delivery in an emergency. Those stakeholders could include, for example, university and college student health clinics, local health centers, the insurance division of DCBS, insurers, and CCOs. This bill doesn't fix everything, but it moves us in the right direction, working to create better plans for health emergencies, better options for students and others who need appropriate medical care, and addressing some of the costs to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Nathan? Would this bill wouldn't apply to out-of-state carriers, would it?
Mr. Chair, no, it would not. I've worked with DCBS to figure out if there's a way for it to cover all students, regardless of where the insurer is licensed, and it will not. We don't have the authority to write regulations on
that. That was a big part of the problem, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed it is.
So we might have to find a way to make OHA available as a backstop, which I think they were available as a backstop, but you may need to take that up as a Ways and Means problem.
Mr. Chair, yes, indeed. It has already presented itself as a Ways and Means or budgeting problem.
Because you have to make sure those kids get vaccinated. Mm-hmm.
That's right. But public health comes first, and then you're left to figure out who's going to pay. But we have some hope that through discussions that OHA would conduct under this bill with student health centers and others, that there may be creative solutions about developing some sort of insurance approach, local Oregon insurance approach, that could address this. It's a possibility.
Thank you very much for your testimony. See what else goes on in this one.
Thank you.
I'll leave both of these hearings open, but let's take some witnesses first on which one's first? 2408. Yeah, on 2408. And let's see who we got.
Kim?
Kim something.
It is Bartholomew? Okay. Kim Bartholomew, Maureen Hinman, and Frank Carapello.
Can we stipulate that we all love school health centers and not spend too much time trying to convince us that they're important? I think we all believe they're important. Please, in any order, introduce yourself.
I'm Kim Bartholomew. I'm the Oregon Director for the National Association of School Nurses. I am on the Oregon School Nurse Association board, and I am a Beaverton School District nurse.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm not going to be popular up here right now because I don't think we have the money right now to fund school-based health centers when we desperately need school counselors and social workers in the schools. Beaverton's going to be laying off staff, and that staff layoff will include a social worker. I have issues with funneling new money into the school-based health center and the Alliance for technical expertise when we're laying off mental health professionals. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I am not anti-school-based health center. I love working with my school-based health center. I was at Virginia Garcia School-Based Health Center yesterday working on the dental sealant program, ensuring the success of the program for our students in our Title I schools. With regards to Section 2, I hope that the intent of the wording is to throw money into the schools for these mental health needs. School counselors are not required. Neither are school nurses. Right now, there are over 100 school districts without a school nurse, and there are many, many schools that don't have school counselors. And that is wrong, especially when you look at the mental health needs that we have in elementary school children. This is not a high school issue. This is an issue starting with kids in elementary school. I really find it baffling why we're pushing the pilot program to put social workers in school-based health centers. Section 3 of this bill is basically the same as Senate Bill 278, House Bill 2648, and House Bill 2568. And with Senate Bill 278, it's got a $20 million price tag for the pilot program, and then another $4 million ask. So we're looking at $24 million. So if you were to give that money directly to Oregon Department of Education, that would fund 140 social workers for 2 years of this pilot program. And the people would be placed directly in the schools. So if you do that, you look at 140 social workers. Even if you put them in one school with 600 kids, that's 85,000 kids whose lives would be impacted positively by having a social worker or a counselor in that school. Social workers could be embedded directly in the neediest schools, the Title I schools, the schools with a disproportionate number of minorities. There's a plethora of data to indicate that a trauma-informed approach to education is absolutely necessary. All day, every day. But what you need to understand is that school-based health centers are freestanding medical clinics, just like any other medical provider, just like in my area, Metropolitan Pediatrics or the Children's Clinic. They're a freestanding mental health unit, freestanding medical home for the physical needs of children. They are not part of the school system. So even if they're housed on site, they don't have access to the children. Children have access to school-based health centers. So we can send kids to school-based health centers. And when they're sited at a high school, the kids can walk right over and have access to the providers there. But if you're in any other school in that district, somebody, your parents or somebody else has to bring you there just like they would for a regular provider. And when you look at this pilot program, you have the school-based health center as the middleman. If you put the money directly into the schools, you cut out the middleman, and that's an expensive option because the way the bill is written, you have you partner with another organization, and it's intended to be a school-based health center, although little c does say it could be another organization. But whoever's hired has to have experience with a school-based health center, so we know that in essence that's what it is. It's a school-based health center and a school partnership. We don't need that. We already have many trained people in the schools. We have many experts statewide. Trauma-Informed Oregon has 29 organizations and individuals throughout the state who are already experts in trauma-informed approach. And that information is being disseminated all over the state now. Trauma-informed approach to education is embedded in PBIS. Teachers are getting trained in this whenever they do PBIS at school. Aloha Huber Park, one of my schools, they had a training yesterday. They had in a specialist in trauma-informed approach. One of my principals went to a trauma-informed approach summit this last week in Salem. And it was a whole child summit. There were over 500 people at that summit.
Can you wrap it up?
Okay, and so it's very important to fund the money where it's needed in the schools directly and not with the school-based health centers. School-based health centers are incredible in what they offer. I will definitely give you that. And I will support other legislation. 2174 puts the social workers and the counselors directly in the school.
I support that bill, by the way. I just want to tell you that unpopular opinions are always welcome in this community.
What I didn't have the opportunity to tell you is that I told you the school-based health centers don't have access to the kids. Kids have access to the school-based health centers. If we put a social worker there, that person cannot come in and get any individual student information, no information about absenteeism, no family information, no other mitigating information. If you place the worker in the schools, they can work directly with the school staff.
Thank you. I'm sorry I turned you on again.
I'm sorry, I'm passionate.
Next, please.
Kenny Geyer has a question.
Was Kenny Geyer, do you know?
Can I ask a question of her?
Yes, please.
At risk of turning you on again.
Uh-oh.
No, I love school-based, I love school nurses, behavioral health people, counselors in the schools as well. But one of the dilemmas is that we have to keep, it takes money from the state school fund unless you allocate general fund. And one of the things that is appealing, of course, about the school-based health clinics is that it's reimbursable so that we can get other payers. So I know there's been conversations about trying to fund school nurses a different way, and I just wonder if there's any been any progress on that.
We have Senate Bill 111, which would let us go through and use Medicaid money. But the issue I see with that is we're asking the state to reimburse the state, in essence, instead of asking the private organizations to pay their fair share when we provide medical care to their children, sometimes with a one-on-one nurse, in the schools every day.
That is the dilemma. Mm-hmm. That is exactly the dilemma. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name's Maureen Hinman. I'm from the School-Based Health Alliance. And I'm going to skip my prepared testimony and see if I can speak to some of the questions that have come up and maybe a better description of the bill, because I feel like we actually have some really similar goals and that there's a misunderstanding of what the bill does. So School-Based Health Center expansion, about that, I really just want to add that we have been working actively with CCOs to try to work on figuring out alternative payment methodologies and ways to use their community benefits programs. We've been hosting regional convenings of SBHCs, local public health authorities, and CCOs around the state. And we're working in a work group in the Tri-County area right now with HealthShare, Care Oregon, and Family Care, to specifically try to identify an alternative payment methodology. And I did want to mention that SBHCs leverage $4 for every one that the state puts in. So it's a very good investment. The school-based mental health expansion piece, there is already a system in place in the Oregon Health Authority to distribute funding to schools for mental health. Some of it goes to school-based health centers, but some of it goes directly to schools. So this ask is not in opposition to the social worker bill, and it's not in opposition to putting mental health workers directly into schools. It does both already. The third section is really trauma-informed schools is about applying what the health sector has learned about trauma-informed care, which it's true. Many, many people in the health sector are getting trained, and this is becoming ubiquitous. But that's not necessarily true in the education system. It is new to them. There are very few schools that have implemented a trauma-informed approach which is a little bit different and added on to PBIS. And what this allows us to do is a comprehensive, systematic analysis and evaluation of the process, what it costs, and what some of the non-financial contributions can be as well. And we're also connecting with CCOs to help us with that project. So we're looking to leverage community funding for the schools in that way as well. I think that I will wrap it up there, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the board, members of the committee. My name is Frank Carapello. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Reynolds School District, which is serves AL over 11,000 students in East Portland, parts of Gresham, out to Troutdale and Fairview. Reynolds High School serves over 2,600 students. Three-quarters of the students in our district are students living in poverty, serving in our district close to 70 students who speak 70 languages. Over 50% of Reynolds High School are current or former English language learners. Over 11% of our district, roughly, are qualified as homeless in 2016. Yet Reynolds High School does not have a student-based health center. I'm here in support of House Bill 2408, as we are in the process of trying to figure out how to get from here to there. And this bill certainly, and the supports that it would provide, would help us to get there, to be able to establish a health student-based health center at Reynolds High School. Student data that was recently shared with us by Kaiser Permanente for our general population generally demonstrate health disparities and disparities of access for Reynolds students, with significant disparities in wellness checkups, immunizations, obesity, and pre-diabetic complications. As I said, Reynolds High School lacks a student-based health center, and I believe that it is an imperative for in helping our students to be successful both academically and physically in their community. Our social worker spends much of her time transporting students to the student-based health center located at Centennial High School, taking her out of the building for appointments for up to half a day at a time. So while we do have school-based social workers, they spend most of their time meeting the needs of students and transporting them elsewhere to get some of those needs met. So again, it would be imperative for us to see ways to improve access for our students in their community, both at our high school and for our community at large. We do support a trauma-based approach to instruction and are working actively towards that. But also recognize that there is an absolute correlation between student health and academic achievement. So this is an area that this bill would certainly support us in getting there. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I missed what percentage of students you said are homeless in your, it was a high school or district?
The latest data I had was approximately 11% of the district, Rue McKinney-Vento, qualified in 2016.
I also assume most of the students that qualify for free lunches are covered in a CCO.
I will defer. Yeah.
Why aren't the CCOs in the area working with you to make sure those kids get cared for?
Thank you, Chair. So one of the interesting things that I've learned over the past year as we've gone down this road. Is essentially that we've tried to develop our network of who do we talk to get this going? How do we get from here to there in establishing this clinic? And we've spent a good deal of time developing our network. And what we found out is we've asked, where's the binder? Give me the binder that shows me how to do this. I'm an educator. I'm not in the healthcare field. So I need something that will guide us on how to get there. I don't believe that exists in the state that we have found. No one's turned, give me the binder, I'll open a page one and get started on how to do this. What we have found is that we work through Multnomah County Health Department. They've referred us to the coalition. We are in desperate need of that help and assistance. I think this bill, part of it could create that framework for how to get there with other districts as well. I guess my point would be there is still a need for the student-based health centers out there, particularly in our area and other parts of the state as well. So I don't have a good answer about why our CCO is not in there. It's just out of my field of expertise.
I'll refer him to you. Thank you very much. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
You've been quiet today.
Nice to see you. I was thinking the same exact thing. So I understand your answer. So have you had any actions with the CCOs to try to develop this option for places like Reynolds School District? Why aren't the CCOs responsive to this need?
If I could speak to that, Representative Bueller, we as kind of a field work with CCOs to try to connect them when we are developing school-based health centers. And like I said, when we're working on this, the trauma-informed schools piece, we are actively working with CCOs to leverage any kind of investment they can make. So for example, our pilot program that we're doing right now has influenced the development of a significant investment that Kaiser is going to be making in trauma-informed schools. They'll be releasing a grant any day now where schools are going to be able to access their funds to do this. So we are working on developing this. I think it's hard for schools on their own to access it, but that as a like a school health community, we have some of that work happening.
But it sounds like two-thirds of their students are probably current members of either family care or health care.
Yeah.
And they're taking care of them in a very inefficient way now, in a clinic somewhere where it seems to me.
We're hoping to have a summit this summer with the CCOs, the Oregon School Nurse Association, with several other organizations, because what we're suggesting is for the CCOs to throw a little money our way to have a school nurse in the schools, because if we have a school nurse in the school, then we can help them meet their metrics. They get paid extra when they meet those metrics. So why not have us do some of the assessment about diabetes, about asthma, about those things? Let us help them meet them right there in the school where we are, and then let them get their bonuses and let us be paid for. Bob.
Chair, if I may.
We've got four more bills and four more witnesses on this one. So.
I just want to make a point. I think this is one of the limits of our current CCO model. There's not a coordinating entity for public health and community health initiatives, and I think we need to think more deeply about that. I see this hole developing in lots of areas.
Hey, would you call the next panel, and can you comment while we're doing that?
Well, we have Representative.
Sure. So, yeah, just my comment was I liked Rep. Bueller's comment, and there's a lot of look at Transformation 2.0 and CCOs, and I think that would be good for us to look at while we're doing that. And I also think that one of the values of this bill is the planning money that is not just the $3 million for the school-based health clinics, but the up to $1 million for the planning money. And I would hope that part of that planning would be those connections with CCOs and the school nurse programs.
Why don't we have our comments while we're calling the next panel. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, I just wanted to comment. I love the idea of the trauma-informed care. I'm a huge advocate, want to see our kids cared for in any way we can. I do think we need to be cautious, though, in making sure that we have the parental involvement. I have some concern in that we have our schools then coming in before our parents and not having our parents as involved in the child's care by having so many school-based facilities. So I am an advocate for connecting the CCOs to the parents and making sure that we have that parent involvement, and would like to see us head that direction. But I also understand I don't like the dollars coming out of the state school fund, and so there's a lot of discussion, but I think we need to continue the conversation. But I think it is very important that we keep the connection with the parents.
It's especially important when the parents are sometimes the cause of the trauma, and getting them involved in the in the thing is a very important piece. Yeah. Okay, four more witnesses for this.
Jodell Marks, Melissa Schatz, Alberto Moreno, and Doug Riggs. And you're going to have to start putting people out of time off because we spent 40 minutes.
Yeah, we're having real time problems, so please keep it short. Somebody.
Okay. Morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jodell Marks. I am a senior at Jefferson High School in Portland, Oregon, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 2408. Last year, I went into my school-based health clinic with a sore throat. I figured I had strep throat. And after receiving negative test scores, my symptoms continued to worsen. Over the course of the next few months, I went into the school-based health center weekly and became very, very... my symptoms continued to get worse. I was very exhausted. I was going to bed at 7 o'clock at night with tears in my eyes, and I was still tired. And I, because of the school-based health center being at my school, I was able to, I didn't miss as much class as I would have, having to travel off campus. And, I was able to receive the supportive care, from the medical physicians there, and I received mental health services there, which made it possible for my nurse practitioner to talk to my counselor and figure out that my symptoms were not because of diabetes or mono or thyroid issues, which I was tested for, but because of anxiety. And because of that, after they determined that and diagnosed me with anxiety, I was able to take control of my health. And I participated in a COPE group this year, which allowed me to receive support from my peers and see people who were going through the same struggles, and as well as give my support to them and gain perspective. And the health center has been an integral part of my making it to senior year and being successful. And I would like to see future students provided with the same option of health care at an affordable cost and convenient. Yeah. Thank you.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Yes.
All right, top that one.
I will try. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Schatz. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm an employee of Outside In, and I'm the behavioral health specialist at the Milwaukee High School School-Based Health Center. We provide integrated primary care and outpatient mental health services. I also want to say that I work very closely with the school, as personnel with the school district at both Rowell Middle School and Milwaukee High School. I participate on care team, working with the school counselors and the employees to address the needs of schools who are students who are struggling. And I also go over and I work very closely with the social worker at Rowell Middle School to provide support services there. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the middle school and high school students who regularly access mental health services through our clinic and on behalf of their families. We serve students who have a limited access to other health and mental health services for a variety of reasons. A significant percentage of families who utilize our services who have private insurance cannot afford the copays. A significant percentage of families cannot afford to miss work in order to take their child to appointments, especially if these appointments are weekly. And some don't have regular or reliable means of transportation. And for students, missing half a day of school to go to a weekly appointment puts them further and further behind at a time when they're already struggling to keep up. We see a student whose mother called our clinic for help because while she could see her daughter was struggling with depression, she just couldn't afford the $35 per visit copay that her insurance required, and she was already struggling to keep a roof over their head. We see another student whose family lost their housing and subsequently their OHP lapsed, which meant their son could no longer see his regular therapist at a time when their family was in turmoil. We see a student with ADHD and depression whose mother is housebound due to illness. Another student who was diagnosed with depression but had to wait 3 months for the next available therapy intake appointment through their insurance. Only because they can access our school-based health services, they are in school and getting the help they need. We are the safety net. We help students to stay in school both physically and mentally, mind and body. We know that untreated mental health problems lead to school failure and mental health crisis. Without school-based health services, these students fall through the cracks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's my short written statement.
I appreciate it. Hi.
Hi, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noes, esteemed committee members. My name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I want to begin my comments by just saying how proud we are of you. When I grow up, I want to be as articulate as you are at this tender age. There may be or may not be hope for me still, but that's my goal.
She's got plenty of time.
She did great. Schools are the few safe places in our communities where families of all backgrounds come together to learn and thrive. Providing physical and mental health care in schools only makes sense and ensures that kids have the supports they need to be healthy and ready to learn. School-based health centers are an important and proven strategy for ensuring access to health care and reducing health care disparities among low-income minority children and adolescents. This is especially true of our children who often face geographic, economic, and transportation barriers to care. In fact, we know that school-based health centers see minority students at 2 to 4 times greater rates than the percent of the Oregon population. This is especially true of African American students, Native American students, and Latino students. And we know that school-based health centers are the most accessible and practical option for many of our children. And it is for this reason, among many others, that I ask for your support on House Bill 2408. Thank you for your time and consideration this early morning. I thank you.
Ms. Marino. Doug, you want to join us?
I do. And I do follow this seat.
Okay. You're doing it.
What are you up to?
So I'm going to have Jessica come over. I know you don't want to hear from me because you see me all the time. So
you're right.
That's not a surprise.
Whoops.
Yeah. But I do want to share with you the thoughts of a student from Brookings Harbor who was here a couple weeks ago when we had 300 students in the building. He could not be here because it's a 10-hour round-trip drive, but he wanted to share his thoughts on why his school-based health center in rural Oregon on the coast is so important. So I am sitting in for Fernando today.
When I was little, I came here to the school-based health center for all my checkups. Every single checkup, every physical I needed, everything. Just from that, it's actually a really good experience when you get to know, like, to say your nurse, your doctor really well, your physician that takes care of you, because it kind of makes you say, hey, you don't need to worry about anything. They got you in good hands. So that's pretty much how I feel here at the school-based. Here are great people. You know, they know what to do. Creating a circle of trust with multiple people is always really good. And if you start to build those relationships with those people, you start to understand them, you get to actually communicate with them, you get to realize how they work, what they do, how they can help you as a person. Just knowing the people here really makes you feel really comfortable, really comfortable. And I feel that way. And I can walk in here and probably hang out. I wouldn't mind, you know. I could be like, hey, I'm just going to do some stuff. All right. You know, That's the confidence, the trustworthiness that the people here give me, which I can feel can generate to every student that's possible here that can take advantage of it.
So for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the School-Based Health Alliance, and I'll just make one other point, which is in your packet you have a one-pager, and I think the headline on this one-pager is really important. It doesn't say support school-based health centers. We support school-based health centers. I love school-based health centers. I worked for 10 years in Washington County on the Children and Families Commission with Representative Malmstrom to dramatically increase the number of school-based health centers. But we're here today to talk about school wellness. And school wellness is about school-based health centers. It's about counselors. It's about school nurses. It's about social workers. And we support all the other bills. So we would hope that this bill gets sent down to Ways and Means and gets put in the mix, so if we have additional resources at the end of the session, we can be able to fund it. But this really isn't about one silo. Representative Hayden made the point about the Department of Education, and he's exactly right. Education dollars are limited. These are health dollars from OHA and CCOs and private billing. So it's that wraparound set of circumstances that we can help bring together in a community that is so important, not just SBHCs, but the whole community, helping people like Fernando make sure that he has access to care. So thank you very much.
Doug, thank you very much.
I just have a comment.
Yep.
Chair, I think maybe we're on to some new CTE thing with this. I think we ought to get kids in there and working, and maybe we'll have the next set of doctors and nurses, and, you know, you never know.
Mm-hmm. Probably just could use some kids in the legislature.
Well, yeah, I'm saying in these clinics, I think, I mean, really, seriously.
That's how we can fund them.
It's a CTE whole other way for them to see, have an opportunity to see things. I'm serious.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2408.
Yeah, I mean,
open
seriously.
A public hearing on House Bill 2981 and ask you, Madam Administrator, what we have here.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2981 comes to you at the request of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. The bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to report specific information on a quarterly basis about the processing of applications for medical assistance and for renewals of the medical assistance recipients. Has an emergency clause effective on passage. We have Courtney Johnson, John Mullen, and Art Shahorjevsky.
Not bad.
I need to say it out loud way more times.
This is 2981.
Art.
Okay, guys. Everything you need to say, but not a bit more.
Okay. Representative Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston. I am here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is an association made up of 8 of the 16 coordinated care organizations and affiliated groups providing care to nearly half of Oregon's Oregon Health Plan members. And I just want to emphasize that for a second because we serve nearly half of Oregon's health plan members. I come up here and I say that spiel all the time, and then I talk about the logistical aspects of carrying out the delivery system or the cost of drugs. But we work in a patient-centered care model, and for my CCOs, their focus day in and day out is providing quality care to their members. So I wanted to emphasize that for you today, because over the last year, I've been continually approached by them, COHO plan representatives, with stories about the barriers to care coordination created by our redetermination process. And in looking for solutions, we thought it was important to have a better understanding of what that problem is, and we think that House Bill 2981 is a prudent first step for solving these issues. This is a disclosure bill, and we believe will provide us with information we need to understand what exactly these barriers to improving the redetermination process are. Now, you heard a presentation last week from the Oregon Health Authority about how this process is working and in many cases is not working, and you heard about the month-to-month increases in fee-for-service patients and the subsequent decreases in CCO enrollment and the associated breaks in care coverage that this churn creates. This presentation was heavily focused on data, and I thought it was really informative, and I hope you did too. But I'm not here to repeat those statistics for you today. I'm here because one thing you heard over and over again in this presentation last week was the effect of this process on the members, the disruption to member care continuity, the creation of access with issues with providers, the increased cost to the OHA, and perhaps most importantly, the stress this puts on OHP members. And that's what I want to focus on, the stress to our members. And as I said, I'm here today because I was continually approached over the last year by frontline workers within the CCOs asking what they could do to better serve these patients and telling me stories like this. So I'm going to go into a couple things. An Oregon Health Plan member with type 1 diabetes didn't receive their redetermination notice. The member tried to reach someone at the Oregon Health Authority but didn't have enough minutes on their cell phone to stay on hold. The member learned he was no longer an OHP at his monthly doctor's appointment. Another member with behavioral health diagnosis received their paperwork late. He filled it out and returned the paperwork, but he filled it out incorrectly and was dropped from the Oregon Health Plan. The stress of this caused a mental health crisis, and he was required hospitalization. Another member with cancer learned at her post-treatment follow-up appointment that she had been dropped from Oregon Health Plan. The member had to wait several months for another appointment. This member was waiting to see if she was cancer-free, and this kind of undue stress is what we're really trying to avoid here. Lastly, this story, one of our COHO plans had a member whose son suffered an ankle injury playing baseball. Her provider said that there could be a hairline fracture, but they wouldn't know for sure for 3 to 4 weeks. The doctor asked that the mom bring her son back for a follow-up visit and an x-ray. 3 weeks. 3 weeks later, the mother called for an appointment and was told she was no longer on OHP and they couldn't see her son. The mother was surprised. She sent in the paperwork 6 weeks before that to continue her coverage with OHP. Luckily, that mother worked from home because she was able to continue working while she was on hold for a total of 7 hours trying to find the right person at the Oregon Health Authority to talk to. Finally, the OHA told her there was a minor paperwork error causing her and her whole family to be disenrolled from the Oregon Health Plan. The error was fixed. The Oregon Health Authority told her she would have to be on fee-for-service coverage for 3 to 6 weeks before she would be re-enrolled in the CCO. So the next morning, she called her son's pediatrician to schedule the x-ray, but her son's pediatrician office told her they didn't take fee-for-service, which is common in the state. The office said that they couldn't see the son until she was re-enrolled back in the CCO. So over the next 2 days, the mother called and tried to talk to someone at the Oregon Health Authority to get back into the CCO faster. For 2 days, she was run around to all different people, sometimes being told to talk to the same person she already talked to or to call the CCO for help, which is something we can't do. She logged another 14 hours on hold over those 2 days. Finally, she was told by the Oregon Health Authority that if she needed to get her son an x-ray, to just go to the ER because they have to see people there. This is the real human impact of not having a system that is able to keep people enrolled in a CCO. This incident created a real continuity of care issue for the son and forced an incredibly persistent mother to be on hold for over 20 hours and ended up with the recommendation for a mother to take her son to the most expensive and least effective place to care. I think we can do better, and we think that Hospital 2981 is a good first step.
We are committed to do better this time on this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. After years of transformation, it's really good to see a number of bills this session that really focus on structure, process, outcome issues, both with the Oregon Health Authority and with CCOs. From our perspective, we want to see both entities really succeed. But we are really concerned about enrollment and re-enrollment issues, and I just want to underscore what was just said about the report you heard on the 15th about the impact of retroactivity on Medicaid enrollment. So we were very pleased to see this bill come forward, and we're interested to work on this bill with the proponents. I'm just going to limit my comments today because many of the things that were just presented are common occurrences that we see throughout our legal services network around the state of Oregon. These kinds of concerns are commonplace. One of the improvements to the bill that I would like to see is in section 13J, I believe it is, but it's basically the discussion about a general explanation of why people were denied. We would like more specific information. We would really like to drill down on these issues so that we have an understanding about how enrollment and re-enrollment is working and where there are problems. So with that, Mr. Chair, just say we would be interested to work on this bill going forward. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Yeah.
Good morning, Art Suhorzewski, representing Family Care Health. I'm going to, Vice Chair Greenlake and Vice Chair Nosen, Vice Chair Hayden, I'm going to try to condense my remarks because I think Courtney and the gentleman next to me did quite a good job explaining the bill and why we think it's absolutely necessary. I just want to offer the committee a few key data points for us internally at Family Care. 49% of our members lose coverage in the first 48 months of enrollment. So that means nearly half of our members lose coverage in a year's time, and that means they lose continuity of care, they lose access to 4,000 of our primary care and specialty care providers, and that is a huge disruption for their livelihoods, as Courtney was able to explain in specific cases. It takes oftentimes 40 days or more for an application to be processed at OHA, and that's specific to family care re-enrollments. We tracked in 2016 almost 10,000 discrepancies in applications, whether that could be errors in the application itself. It could mean that the OHA does not have the correct address for the individual that we have. And oftentimes when a member calls us and is asking for assistance, we are unable to tell them whether they are enrolled at all in OHP because we can't see inside the system whether to confirm whether they actually have fee-for-service coverage. So we can't really help them, and we would love some access to see that information within OHA itself. Some of the other things that we have to deal with. In December, the OHA promised to hold one-on-one meetings with CCOs to help facilitate some of the information that we're asking for in the legislation. We have yet to have that meeting. So we would love to have a one-on-one sit down to kind of drill down into the data that we know that they have. The other issue is that they suspended the sharing of their dashboard of eligibility and enrollment data in December, and we would love to get back to that kind of reporting. So really, this bill is absolutely necessary to continue informing us why the eligibility enrollment system isn't functioning as intended. So thank you so much.
I can tell you there are a couple of bills in this. My co-chairs and I are absolutely committed to getting some solution to this problem in this session. So we thank you for bringing this bill.
Can I ask a quick question, Mr.
Chair? Yes, Representative Nose and then Representative Kinnaman.
So the bills that the chair referenced seem to sort of study the problem, but they don't seem to solve it. And I'm unclear how would we solve this problem. If we just wanted to stop this ridiculousness, how would we do that?
Well, I would suggest, rather than answering that we get together with the bills and the OHA people and figure out how to solve this problem and do it in this session.
It's ludicrous that someone would be in hold for 7 hours. That's ridiculous.
Well, that's a cumulative. It's probably only 4 hours and 3 hours. It's not that bad. I think the notion, though, I think it was really clear, came out of the session we had before, is that CCO members, when they're reinstated, need to go right back into the CCO, not coming through.
Right.
I think that's clear, and we're prepared to talk about that. Representative Hayden has a bill, and we have a couple other bills, and we're going to be working with you and with OHA to get a solution. This is absurd.
Yeah.
Mr. Kinnaman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a similar experience. My 7-year-old grandson broke his arm Friday or Saturday. Took 4 days to get properly treated and with a major health care provider. His mother is only a PhD, so she's
a
bright lady.
Hard to figure out the company.
And it was just amazing. They didn't treat certain kinds of injuries on certain days.
Oh.
And no, honest to goodness, you know, you felt like you needed a drink to get through the day. It was just amazing.
Well, that's a separate problem than the enrollment problem with you.
But it's related to this whole failure to create treatment. The hours that she spent calling could have been spent a lot more productively on both sides, the healthcare organization and others.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we're hearing you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2981 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3014. What do you have on that, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3014 is before us today at the Chief sponsor is Representative Kennemer at the request of the Oregon Society for Respiratory Care. The bill requires individuals seeking an initial license to practice respiratory therapy on board the license by reciprocity to practice respiratory therapy to hold a credential as a registered respiratory therapist. Mr. Chair, we have Bill Cohagen. Cohagen. And Joe.
Good morning. My name is Joe Dwan. I represent the Oregon Society for Respiratory Care regarding HB 3014. We're requesting that we require the advanced registered respiratory therapist as the minimum for Oregon respiratory therapy licensure. The intent is for new grads and out-of-state RTs to obtain the RRT credential for Oregon licensure. It is not the intent to affect current licensed or Oregon-licensed certified respiratory therapists that are in good standing with the Health Licensing Office. I have over 40 years' experience as a respiratory therapist. I've retired as the director of respiratory at Kaiser Permanente. A lot has changed since RTs became licensed in 1992. Technology has advanced dramatically. It's kind of like comparing a Model T Ford to what we used back in the 80s and 90s to the computerized cars of today. Respiratory therapists take care of patients from premature babies all the way through grandma and grandpa, dealing with any kind of respiratory illness, which could include neurological problems, cardiac problems, renal problems. And we, in addition to dealing with things like asthma and chronic lung disease, we also provide life support. The technology has advanced dramatically in the past 25 years. The knowledge that we have through evidence-based medicine has really changed quite a bit. Hospitalizations has changed quite a bit. Used to have really long length of stays where patients were healed in the hospital. Now, after their acute phase is done, they're sent home. The certified respiratory therapist is a basic skill competency that's tested at the national level. The advanced level, the RRT level, which is what we're asking for, requires further testing and further competencies. In Oregon, we have the support of certainly the OSRC. We have support of the four RT schools who are training new graduates. And we have support of all the managers we've spoken to. Thank you.
Senator or Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee, I'm Bill Cohagen. I'm a registered respiratory therapist of over 38 years. I'm currently the manager of respiratory therapy at Salem Hospital. I'm also a professor of respiratory care for Independence University and the president of the OSRC. We brought this forth because with the changes of our profession, and we're not the first state to do this, we're following suit with California, Ohio, Arizona. Washington is working on a similar bill at this time. To help promote this profession, to provide the best care for our patients possible with the best trained therapist, the schools are very supportive of us because they train to the same level as what we're promoting with the registered respiratory therapist. The NBRC exam that we as therapists take now have one test with two different cut scores. The higher the cut score means they're a registered respiratory therapist. The schools are held to the standard that they, by their credentialing bodies, to have the respiratory therapists get this RRT credential, and that's what they teach to. So this is what the students coming out are already being taught. Our profession, that through the AARC, is very supportive of this whole movement of raising our profession across the entire United States. So we want to make sure that we're providing the best care with the best therapists that we can. Thank you. Oh, one other thing too. We have also worked with the OHA on this, and they have helped us tremendously, and we're on the same page with this.
You're certified now, but this would be a different certification level?
It's our profession has two levels. And if you're an RRT, you're already a CRT. It's like going from, I guess, entry level to your next step. And so all of us are at least CRTs, but now most of us are becoming RRTs, which is taking a step higher. The education is more intense, with, especially with all the new technical skills that we have, and we're becoming a very diverse profession.
The competency testing is, there's a national board exam. As Bill said, there's two pass levels. To become a registered therapist, you have to be at the higher level, and then you need to take a second competency exam in order to become a registered respiratory therapist, showing that you have advanced competencies. And that's what we want for the patients in Oregon.
Kind of like an RRT gets an A, and a CRT would be a C student.
All right, well, thank you.
Mr. Kennemer? Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think, the health authority going to speak too?
They did not sign up.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure, put on the record, these gentlemen have been working with the Oregon Health Authority, and there was a dash one amendment. And with that, the health authority is in support of the bill.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3014, and there's an amendment.
In the works.
Good. Thank you very much. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3030. Madam Administrator?
Representative Hayden and his first panel, which would be Tory Rhodes and Emma Myers, and then you will be with Representative Hayden, and then the other three will call up next.
All right. Representative Hayden?
This has to do with nitrous oxide.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noss, members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden. I'm state representative from House District 7, which includes Cottage Grove. This morning we bring to you House Bill 3030 that has to do with dealing with the recreational use of nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide is a regulated substance that we use in medicine, dentistry, in the operating rooms routinely. The boards typically regulate how that medicine is delivered. For an example, it has to come through a system that mandates or makes sure that enough oxygen is mixed with nitrous oxide. The human body cannot live on nitrous oxide alone. You will actually suffocate to death. But your body itself doesn't know that you're suffocating because it's getting the nitrous oxide. And so when that's delivered to patients, particularly minors, it's about 25% nitrous oxide and 75% oxygen. So medical professionals go through a lot of education in order to deliver that through a sedation, a light sedation with nitrous oxide. Interestingly enough, those sedation licenses also have to incorporate what that person may be taking, either over-the-counter or a prescription drug. Say, for example, if a youth went and got their wisdom teeth removed, they might be given a opioid narcotic medication to control the pain short-term. If the dentist had a follow-up visit and provided nitrous oxide at that visit, it would be a moderate to a deep sedation because what is in the blood system already as a CNS depressant, and it can actually lead to significant problems and death if that is not monitored. Surprisingly, our DEA, drug enforcement agencies, don't monitor the recreational use of nitrous oxide. It is monitored in America by the Food and Drug Administration, and they have ability to prosecute for mislabeling nitrous oxide. So most states that do monitor this or regulate the recreational use of nitrous oxide do it at a state level, and many states do have age restrictions on the use of nitrous oxide and how that can be sold. So what we're presenting today for you from the Cottage Grove Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council, which is part of the steering committee for the city of Cottage Grove, is to explore and potentially put some regulations in Oregon, which we don't have, on the recreational use of nitrous oxide, which can be purchased anywhere at any age that sells that product today. Typically, it is sold in a small metal canister called a whippet, for the purpose of making whipped cream, and these students are going to show you how that can, in my opinion and their opinion, this is their bill at their request, can be misused. Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Very interesting. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Victoria Roddy, and I'm a member, I'm the co-president of the Youth Advisory Council. We first came aware about this issue when a mother came to the city council and she was expressing her concerns about her son, who used whippets and then got in an almost fatal car accident. And as I was the member at the city council meeting at the time, I came back to my committee here and we discussed issues about whippets and about how that related to drug use as well. And we did a brief presentation about inhalants and tobacco and dangers to youth. And then we got the opportunity to come up here and we got to talk to Representative Hayden here about what we were working on and what our thoughts of whippets. And he has helped us introduce this bill, and we're very thankful for that.
Mr. Chair and the committee, my name is Emma Myers. I'm a senior at Cottage Grove High School, and I serve as the vice chair of the Youth Advisory Council. I'm here to talk to you about whippets. This is a canister from a whippet. This was bought at a local store in Cottage Grove, and it is used to make whipped cream, but they're not very, not many people are going to be making whipped cream in Cottage Grove, and they're sold all around in almost all the stores. And also sold at some of the stores are these canisters right here. This is what is used when you're using the whippet as a drug. You put it in the canister like this, and then there's a little puncturing thing on the top, and you stick it on the canister, and you screw it in, and it punctures the canister and releases the gas in these two little circles right here. And then you put a balloon on top, and the gas will go into the balloon, and you'll inhale it from there. You don't want to inhale it from just the canister alone, because it will cause you to either freeze your lungs or your mouth, and it can cause some permanent damage. And inhaling it from the balloon can also cause some permanent damage as well. So it's really dangerous. And this is available to all ages. There's no restrictions on it at all. And it is sold in almost all our stores. The woman who came into the council meeting, whose son crashed the car, she went around to the stores that sold it and asked them to remove it from their stores. And only some of them said they would remove it after they sold all of their product. And many of them said that they would not stop selling it because it was a big item. People wanted it and not to buy whipped cream. Thank you for listening. We are open to answering any questions that you have.
What is the bill do specifically? Does it ban the sale? Or?
So what House Bill 3030 currently would do would simply restrict the age to 18. There are we are open to discussion about whether that should be 21 or 18 currently in this bill for purposes of starting a discussion. It is at 18, and there would be a misdemeanor and potentially a fine for that. It does not currently regulate the location or point of sale. That has been another point of discussion, that if there is consideration given to this bill, that we might also want to look at point of sale location, in meaning that are we selling this product where baking goods are sold, where you can buy, you know, a product to bake a cake and put whipped cream on it, or are we selling this product in an inhalant shop where only vaping products are available? It's pretty clear what the use would the intended use to be versus a baking shop and an inhalant shop. So point of sale and age up to 21 could be amended considerations for this bill.
All right, let's hear the other three folks that are here to talk to us.
Ian Dukes, MJ Roddy, and Jennifer McReynolds.
Because there's probably a legitimate use for it sometimes.
Okay, please introduce yourself before you start.
My name is Ian Dukes.
I'm here to talk about inhalants and what they are. Inhalants are any substance. They're usually either common household objects or found in a warehouse or a factory. They are not generally drugs themselves. They're sold to be used at a house or a factory. They're used wrongly as inhalants, which can cause drunk-like symptoms or a temporary high. They can be anything from paints to markers, glues, or, as we're talking about, whippets. They are inhaled and directly into the bloodstream. As soon as they are inhaled, they cause brain damage. Nerves are killed and immediately damaged permanently. They could cause a high anywhere from 5 to 30 minutes. Most of the time they're used not just one at a time, but many in a row, which causes even more problems to the body and the brain. And this causes, they could cause wrecks from people driving while on a high, or people just going somewhere while on a high. They could have temperament issues. Lots of physical interactions could go wrong there. There could also be not necessarily a physical addiction to these products, but a mental addiction. They think they need this to keep this high going, and their mind thinks their body needs it, but it doesn't. This could cause lots of problems in school when teenagers in general, they take these inhalants and it causes a high, and they get very distracted from their schoolwork in general and school, and it causes many problems for them education-wise. They cannot interact at school as well as a normal person, and this causes many problems into their education. Many people can overdose on inhalants, and this has happened before. It stops the heart almost immediately and can be very serious. That's about all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the members of the committee. Inhalants are...
Your name, please.
Oh, my name's MJ Roddy. I'm an eighth grader at Lincoln Middle School. Inhalants can be used between, particularly for teenagers 13 through 18 years old. And on the lower spectrum, 13, 14, 15-year-olds are more commonly to use inhalants, whether this is because they are sold at your local convenience store on the street, because they are, and they're very cheap and easy to get. 10% of teenagers use inhalants, have been used whippets, and this is a serious problem. We've been addressing it at Cottage Grove and our Youth Advisory Council.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Jennifer McReynolds. I'm a senior at the Cottage Grove High School. So we hope we have conveyed to you how dangerous these whippets are and how easily accessed they are. Talking to some other youth in our community, piles of these empty canisters have been found in places that youth like to hang out, and I doubt that they are making whipped cream. So we really hope that this bill will limit the access they have to these canisters to help prevent them from damaging their lives. And we thank you for taking the time to listen to us, and we're happy to answer any questions you have.
You have definitely gotten through to us. I think we're all pretty horrified.
You have a question.
Yeah.
Representative Alonzo Leon. Thank you, Chair. Young people, I am so impressed with all of your presentations. Some of you guys are presenting very professionally. I'm just super impressed, and I'm more impressed that you brought this very important issue in the young people community. The fact that you want to save lives, it just speaks volumes of your efforts. I'm really curious. In addition to taking these inhalants, would you say that young people are taking it in combination with other drugs?
Definitely, yeah. It's okay. One of those things that they want to keep the high going and can make it stronger. So.
And this could definitely be considered a gateway drug to other things.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You guys are great.
Yeah.
You really impressed us. Hope you enjoyed being in the Capitol tonight. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3030. We've asked for, we're going to open a brief work session on House Bill 2664. We've invited a couple of witnesses to talk to us. I think we have, four people who...
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have Ron Vineyard, CEO of Asante.
Roy.
And Denise Huber, Vice President of the Surgical Services for Salem Hospital. If you would come forward.
And then we have a couple more as well.
Yes. We'll have Doug Riggs and Jessica Adamson come
up. Okay. If you will,
Just for the committee, this is the bill this is the Ambulatory Surgical Center Bill Extended Stay. And they're here to speak to the bill and the amendments that have been
There's all sorts of things swirling around this, so we thought it would be useful to have at least brief testimony from folks on it. Have at it.
No amendments.
So, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee.
Correct.
My name is Denise Huber. I serve as the Vice President for Surgical Services here at Salem Health. If you're not familiar with us, we do have two hospitals. One, which I'm sure you're familiar with just here, our magnet-recognized regional referral center. One critical access hospital in rural Dallas, and also primary and specialty medical groups in the area. And thank you for the opportunity to join you in dialogue on your morning this morning. We do oppose this bill as written. I want to make it clear, Salem Health, we understand, we get the shift of care out of the acute setting. In fact, our philosophy is the right care at the right time in the right place. Not everyone requires the resources of a hospital stay. And I think that's very clear to all of us as we figure out how do we afford health care in this country. But House Bill 2664, as written, I think has some flaws and some concerns we have. And I think we can probably do better. At the risk of inspiring some additional bureaucratic effort, I think we can do better with some more thought and a data-driven group to really work this through in the future. I suspect you've heard a lot of opinions about this topic, about extended stay centers, about models in Colorado and Texas and other states. And I think there's a lot of assumptions that go around this topic. What's most expensive? What's safest for patients? What's right? And I think it will serve us as Oregonians best to pursue that safe and efficient care with a formal public process, including a variety of stakeholders. I think data from our own state.
Haven't we been working on it for 4 years with a variety of stakeholders?
If that is the case, Chair Greenlake, I'm not aware of it, but I'm certainly it's possible that it's been there without our process.
Sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask a question? Go ahead. I'll wait.
Yeah, finish.
Better finish.
Okay. I do think part of that process should include reviewing the interaction between this potential type of facility and CMS. Many of our Oregonians are covered by Medicare and Medicaid, and it seems logical to me to ensure access for those patients for whom Oregon is a payer. I do think that's an interesting, it's a complicated topic. I do think patient safety should be at the forefront of this. It is vital for all parts of our healthcare system to function collaboratively. I understand that is easier said than done for our patients who are experiencing a complication of a surgical procedure. I think those patients expect a seamless escalation of care. And I think it's hard to figure out how to do that in this setting. I think our healthcare providers need to come together and have those conversations. And there's a lot of rulemaking and a lot of finer points here if we talk about the patient transfer agreements and what is a local hospital, how far is a local hospital, how far is an acceptable transport for a patient who is suffering a complication from a procedure. I think that's an important thing to nail down for the safety of our patients, not just in urban settings, but also across the state in rural settings. I do think we should review thoroughly what the standards of care should be. You've probably spent some quality time with ORSs that apply to hospitals. Everything from our staffing to our sprinklers is carefully thought through and mandated. And I think robust and ongoing review of meaningful quality data in other facilities is relevant as well. The 5 years proposed in the bill, I think, is too long to wait. So really, and I certainly appreciate the dialogue, if this has been going on for 4 years, let's push this through, let's make a decision, and let's move forward for the state.
I may be wrong. I think it's 6 years we've been here.
Jeez.
Roy, welcome.
Chairman Greenlick, Vice Chairs Noss and Hayden, and members of the committee, first of all, thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. I do not have prepared comments because I didn't know I was going to be here until last night, but I did drive 250 miles this morning through the rain and fog because I feel so passionate about opposition to this bill in its current form. My name is Roy Vineyard. I'm CEO for Asante, which is a small health system in Southern Oregon, consisting of three hospitals, about 230 providers. And we serve about 600,000 people in Southern Oregon, also in Northern California, and are very proud to be able to provide a high level of service to those 600,000 residents. We feel strongly that the current bill would has not been fully vetted, and that's why we support the Dash 7 amendments that I thank Representative Hayden for bringing forward that would establish this process to more fully vet issues around quality of care, around safety, around needs analysis, around building and life safety codes, around potentially around impact on community hospitals of having duplicative infrastructure and equipment available. And you know, to the point of how long this has been discussed and vetted, I have not been involved in those discussions, but if it has, there are still some very, very serious deficits and issues that exist that I feel strongly need to be addressed. No issue with ambulatory surgery centers whatsoever. They played an important role in our communities throughout the state of Oregon. But this is a totally different entity. I mean, this extended stay facility is essentially a mini hospital, 52-hour stay. Our hospital in Grants Pass and in Ashland, you know, three-day length of stay is about the full length of stay. This is, in essence, a mini hospital. I think a lot of care needs to be taken to make sure that we're working together in unison to create something that actually will be better for patient care, for patient safety, and for cost efficiency.
Thank you. Representative Noss? And then Representative Hewlett?
I'll pass for the moment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewlett?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. A couple questions. I guess I'd start off by, do you believe in the goals of the triple aim?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So what's it, and my understanding, we're organizing the health system in Oregon around the goals of the triple aim. So what's inconsistent in this proposal with the triple aim?
Yeah, Chair Greenlick and Representative Buehler, thanks for bringing that up. If anyone's not familiar with the goals of the triple aim, it advances patient quality as well as cost efficiency in the patient experience. Many also say the quadruple aim and involve our caregivers in making sure that those individuals are taken care of as well. Absolutely, we support the triple aim, and I think that's kind of where I need to go with more data. I think there's a lot of assumptions that an ASC is automatically a more cost-efficient place to receive care. I don't know that that's true. I'd like to really dig into that. There's absolutely, certainly no argument that many procedures don't need to be performed in a hospital. But then there's also those procedures, if you think about economies of scale and the sheer number of procedures performed at some hospitals, sometimes that more expensive purchasing stuff actually does flow cheaper through a hospital. It's very difficult. I certainly don't have inside information on anybody else's costing procedures, but I've absolutely had patients come to me and say, gosh, look at this bill from an ASC. It's actually more than the hospital quoted me for the same case. And so that's why I think we need to figure out this on a really data-driven basis.
I'm really glad to hear you say that, because there's a robust amount of studies with regards to this topic in terms of quality, patient experience, and lower costs. So I'd really encourage you to look at that data so that you just don't, you know, talk about anecdotal experiences, but really what the data shows with regards to this issue.
And I don't think the current version is a three-day stay. I think the current version is a two-day stay.
No, it's 52 hours, which is 2.2 days, or, essentially.
Well, 48 hours plus some options for early morning.
So I was just making the observation that many hospitals have a three-day or less length of stay. So this is, you know, can come very close to hospital-based facility services.
All right, thank you very much.
Representative Alonzo Leon, then I'll go.
You want
to let her go first.
You get back in line. Okay, Alonzo Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So this is a new conversation for me, and I really appreciate folks from both sides come to my office and provide me with some of this information. And certainly when you get new information, you take this information home and you process it. And a couple questions came up for me that I didn't ask, and I'm asking this today. But and actually, it sounds like that's a common question. Do these facilities, the ASCs, have the necessary equipment and tools to handle extended stay for patients? So that's a question that I came up with, and it sounds like people
We have the supporters coming up next.
Oh, perfect. Okay, then I'll get that answered. And then the other question I had, and maybe the supporters will also answer this question, do we have an assessment from the community? Are they saying we need this? We need to have these facilities extend longer in the facilities. So I'm curious about that too. Thank you.
So first, my question to both of you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are both of your hospitals members of the Hospital Association?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Did they keep you abreast of the work group that we had meeting since the bill was first considered in 2015 and 2016?
Well, I understand that there was a, I think it was a non-legislative session in maybe Salishan a couple of years ago. I'm not aware of any additional sanctioned work groups that have been enforced since that time.
Mr. Chair, just a statement.
Yeah, so I specifically authorized a group of people to be working on it as far back as, I think, 2014.
Here's my frustration, which is there was a work group. It was not staffed by anybody in the legislature, but it met periodically. And we have been trying to work this out, and I just feel like the objections that we're getting might be good ones, but or appropriate ones to consider, but they have kind of been brought up at the last minute, and I'm concerned that people haven't been trying to work this out in good faith, where they've just been opposed all along, rather than raising their concerns and actually giving us an opportunity to figure it out. So I'm pretty frustrated.
And Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, I think that's an excellent point, and I'm certainly, I have not been involved in the 2014 and 15 work groups. I was in a different role at the time. Is there a way to push the issue? Because what I've heard about is some informal stuff, some discussion back and forth, but not necessarily the right people being at the table. And where do we bring the voice of the patient in?
Is there a way to push this? The Association was invited to bring anybody to the table they wanted to bring. This is frustrating to us because it sounds like, all right, you've been screwing around with it for 4 years, now let's do it for another 4 years and we won't have to worry about it.
Right.
I mean, that's the way it's feeling to us. It may not be the case, but
really certainly understand that, Chairman Greenlick, and it's not our goal to delay this process, but to make sure that it is fully vetted and that we can guarantee and assure quality and patient safety. I understand the frustration and don't want or mean to delay the process, but I don't want to see something go forward that I think may have unintended consequences that are not good for our communities.
One final comment, Mr. Chair. So here's also my frustration, which is I tried to listen to your association's concerns and viewpoints about this. I have not wanted to use an expression we use somewhere around times around here, roll and just shove a bill down, over your objections. But I'm pretty disappointed at the way that I have learned about
your concerns, and I don't know what to do about it, because they might be legitimate concerns, but I don't feel like we've been given them in an appropriate way and allowed to actually vet them. It feels to me like it's not a real compromise. It's just a stall tactic.
Let's hear the next group. And I really do appreciate you driving 250 miles in the rain. You should have called in or something.
Thanks, Chairman. Now you tell me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Director Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. What I want to do is share with you, looks like Jessica's getting all hooked up, a few slides which I think are going to explain exactly what is happening here.
Very few, because we have another bill to hear.
Right, I agree. So I'm not going to go through this. This is the fourth hearing that we've had on this issue. We've had multiple witnesses. We've had... the chairman is correct. This first came up actually in 2013, and bill was introduced, drafted in 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017. So the industry is moving in this direction anyway. So there are licenses in other states, which we've talked about. There's very good data from five different states on cost comparisons. There is no doubt about the cost comparison issue. There's also very good data on quality measures. So there isn't organ-specific data because we don't have extended stay centers or convalescent care centers. So, but there is plenty of data out there, and we've outlined this with the committee. I do want to just say this is, from my perspective, since I've been involved in this, a three-year process. It began with the pre-session filing of a bill by Jennifer Williamson back in 2014. We had discussions with every member of the committee at that time, and we had a hearing. That led to a work group appointed by Chair Greenlich to go and try to work out. Everyone who testified was invited to that work group, including hospitals. And we sat in a room and we met three or four times, and it took a long time to kind of understand the basics behind the bill, what the data was. And by the time we came back, it was May, and it was the session was over. And so the chair said, I'll have an interim hearing on this. Keep talking. So we came back and we had a hearing in September 23rd of 2015. That led to a stakeholder meeting, which was referred to earlier, with about 15 stakeholders at the Coast at Salishan. That led to changes in the proposal or reintroduction of the bill 2570 for 2016. Another hearing, but we were in a short session. So the chair appointed Representative Nose to convene all stakeholders, and there were 13 participants in that first meeting that was held. There were phone conversations both before and after with initial stakeholders. And the Hospital Association was at that meeting and was very actively engaged in telling us what their concerns were and what they thought would be important. We subsequently followed up, and I had at least 35 specific meetings on this. My goal was Representative Nosa's goal to try to come up with something that was in middle of the road. I've been around this process a long time. I've dealt with very difficult issues, more difficult than healthcare. Water in Central Oregon is an even more controversial issue, as Representative Bueller knows. And we have successfully overturned appeals court decisions and worked together with Water Watch and others to try to get something done. So I know how the process works, and my goal is to be collaborative. So we had many, many discussions. I know a number of legislators met with folks. We met with OHA, and we released, and you have a copy of it, this document here that's color-coded, and it tells you which organization, including the Hospital Association, asked for which changes or had which concerns. The yellows are the concerns and the issues that the Hospital Association raised with me, and every one of those was put in this draft, which I sent out to people I think the end of August, but I handed it out to everybody during Ledge Days, including the Hospital Association and hospitals, and Jessica had a copy of this. So this was very transparent. We had a lunch. Many of you came to. We talked about this. We submitted this bill framework, which was, you know, probably if you start out and ASCs being 1 and hospitals being 10, our position is 1, their position is 10, worked. Or at a 7, which is much closer to the hospital position than my position at the beginning of the year. Had more discussions with Providence, as Jessica will say. And I'll just point out, I was willing to have a discussion with anyone, and I did. And Representative Nose met with all the groups. So we met and had an open door. This was not a secret. There was documentation out there. There were hearings. We all knew about it. And we had a February hearing, and we've been working over the last few weeks to try to get an even better bill, including incorporating the mileage limit that Salem Health's Vice President referred to earlier. So this is in the dash fives, a mileage limit for the transfer agreements, because we thought that was a legitimate issue. So I will just leave it at that. You have on the other piece of paper a list of the 10 different ways that we changed the bill. We've come from 96 hours total down to 48. The Hospital Association raised the issue of a limit because they didn't want rural hospitals to be impacted, so we finally agreed to a limit of 16. The Hospital Association and the hospitals raised the ownership issues, so now fully half, at least fully half of these will be joint ventures between ASCs and hospitals. Patient safety ought to be just as high in those as it would be any place else, I would assume. And we agreed to that. And this was a tough pill for my members to swallow. This was very difficult for us to swallow. Life safety, there are a number of sections in the bill, and I will point you to one section in particular on the second page, lines 7 through 18 specifically talk about patient safety, patient care through the rulemaking process will be set up. Another issue the Hospital Association raised is the concern that out-of-state companies from out-of-state would come in and set up many extended care centers and have no track record in Oregon, so we added that provision. There's a fly-by-night. You got to have 2 years of experience. That's patient safety. Emergency transfer agreements, again, in there because what the Hospital Association asked for. 15 miles is what I referred to, Medicare notifications, so we know that Medicare patients know exactly what's covered and what's not covered. Lots of data and reporting.
Are we holding questions?
In OHA language. So, I'm pretty much done, and I'd be happy to take questions. But it's a very lengthy process. It's led into 4 years. again, I've had to go back to my board 3 or 4 times and say, look, I know you want 72 hours. I know you think that it ought to be medical necessity determines how long a patient stays. But if we're going to get this through, we need to be flexible. We need to agree to the requests that the hospitals and the hospital association have made. And I have personally gone to bat for reasonableness. And I think we're there. Last point I'll make is I think this is a great bill. And I think it's a great bill because it's been a process and we've incorporated lots of ideas. And because it doesn't say this is the way you're going to do it and start it tomorrow. It says here are the guidelines. And the Oregon Health Authority, which is responsible for patient safety and making sure that the system works correctly, will have a rulemaking. All of us will be at the table during the rulemaking. And so things like emergency transfers and patient safety and standards, we have to comply in the bill with all the same standards that overnight stays at hospitals will comply with. So all those issues will be locked into a rule. So I am perfectly confident that the safety provisions will be there. And the last thing I'll say, my second last thing is it's limited. So we will have data reported on an annual basis in rulemaking. If we want to have an annual report, I think that's fantastic. But we'll know, I think, if this is working. Right, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm supportive of the ASCs, but I've just got heartburn, too, here because we've got so many folks that have come to see me that have such a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And while it says all these meetings occurred and everything happened, they're all saying that it didn't. So, I mean, I can't say that, I mean, I haven't been here as long as a lot of you all have, but this is the first time I've had that many people come and say it's not true. So while I want to be supportive, I also am having to really question whether or not folks really were either brought to the table or were listened to. And I do have a question. When you say that you had an agreement or that you brought folks to the table, one example that I'm going to put out there is the mileage issue. Salem Health said, we want 5 miles, agreed to 10 miles. You gave them 15, yet you say that's an accepted agreement.
Yeah.
How is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, I'm not saying that's an agreement. I'm saying that we made an attempt to come up with something that was reasonable that I think fits the model. I had long discussions with Salem Health last week about a variety of issues, and this is one of them. And we think that having a transfer agreement in a reasonable mileage limit is great. They proposed 5, and I said, well, what happens if it's 5.1 or 5.2? I proposed 15, and then Justin got back to me and said, no, they couldn't agree to that. But what I'm saying, Representative Hack, is I was trying to be reasonable and come up with something that would work in the Portland area, in the Salem area. What people don't want to see happen is you put someone in the ambulance, and this really happens very seldom. The data on the slide shows you hardly anyone is transferred from these extended stay centers. There were 5 in Colorado in the entire system last year, only five of the entire state. But when it happens, you want them to be able to get to the hospital quickly. And so it's not in my members' best interest to send someone to Vancouver or Burns. So I was willing to put something in the bill that would address that.
Kind of a follow-up. But I think that's my concern. I'm just using that as an example. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong as far as the distance, but when you say this is an accepted agreement and it starts at 5, goes to 10, ends at 15, that's not consensus, though. That's what's hard. That's not folks coming together and agreeing.
If I suggested it was an agreement or agreed to, I did not mean to suggest that. So I meant to suggest that we incorporated a lot of the concepts in here to the best of our ability.
Go offline and I'll show you the information that says that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We are Oregon's largest hospital and health system, and here in strong support of this bill with amendments that we are still continuing to work on collaboratively with the ASC Association. I was here 2 years ago as the only hospital to testify against this bill when it was first heard. And when we were here, we were concerned about the bill as it was written. We were concerned about a need for a broader dialogue. And while we were pleased the bill didn't pass in 2015, when we met in November of 2015, I committed then to Representative Buehler and to those who were part of the committee and part of the process, to the ASC Association, that Providence would lean in on this issue and work to find a way to make this model work in Oregon. And we would attest that throughout this period of time, there's been a lot of opportunity to engage. We were there on behalf of Providence and Providence alone, but there were many, many, many opportunities for others to come to the table and try and find common ground. And certainly we worked hard. I think it's impressive that Doug's arm isn't broken because we pushed really hard to be clear and on the record. The issue.
Broken, but he can't get an appointment today.
There you go. He used to come see Providence. We'll take good care of them. So the idea of the joint venture ownership was ours. We felt like that was really important. If you're going to create extended stays, there's expertise that comes with hospital systems in providing that level and length of care. We felt that that was important. It was a lengthy set of conversations that were very hard to get to where we are today, and we are comfortable with where we are. As Doug said, this is a first step. Most hospital regulations are not in statute. The day in, day out of where sprinklers need to be and how you staff and the requirements and the very specific stuff, it's all in OHA rule. This will create a RAC, a rule advisory committee, that process very similar, and to bring all of that into the ASCs for extended stay centers. And if we did not believe that was the case, I would not be here testifying in support. What we believe that this bill will enable us to do, just like Providence supports enabling practitioners to practice at the top of their licenses, to enable people to get the most out of their professional credentials, this will enable us to make sure that we're able to use hospitals for the very sickest of patients, for those with comorbidities, to really engage at that level, but to create an opportunity for a different care setting that can treat patients at a appropriate quality at a lower cost in another way that will be available for those with a lower set of acuity to get in and get out. One of the things that we really push for, this bill isn't actually about a 48-hour extended care center. What this is 48 hours from the time they check in at the ASC for surgery. So there are many others around the country that it's 48 hours in the extended care center itself, or 72, or no limit at all. What this says is from the time you enter the ASC for surgery, which may be a 12-hour event. If you're there for 12 hours, then you're only allowed to stay 36 hours in the ASC center. There are additional qualifications that are coming into the dash 5, what will be a dash 8, we guess, amendment, that will say that it can only be for patient safety or for clinical necessity as determined by the medical director to allow anyone to stay past that 48-hour limit. I would also point out that the CMS waiver requirements, it was raised that this may not be available for Medicaid and Medicare. One of the requirements under this bill, and further specified in the amendments that are coming, is that OHA will have to provide a waiver request to CMS for multiple reasons. One, to enable Medicare and Medicaid participation, but two, and this is of particular importance to my organization, to allow for a single license between an ASC and an ASC extended care center. So these are one entities with one ownership, with similar staff, and it creates a single point of accountability. That's only possible if we get a waiver, and we did a lot of digging to try and find a way to do that without a waiver. But there will be strict requirements for them to submit for that waiver, and we will be pushing hard for it to be approved. But even without that, we believe that the promise of this bill is really about meeting the triple aim. It's about looking forward. It's about healthcare transformation, and transformation is hard. It really is. It requires different thinking and a change in business model. It requires everyone to get uncomfortable. We have done that over the past couple of years, and
Jessica,
hope this bill moves.
I need to call this.
Apologize.
You've got a week or two to talk to people, but let's get the amendments, and we'll consider it a little bit at that point. We'll figure out what to do. Probably another week or 10 days. I'm going to close this work session. We've well run out of time. I'm going to ask if the patients that have two more witnesses on House Bill 3276. We have an open public hearing on that. Would you call two witnesses? And then if other people want to testify, we'll carry it over till Monday.
Andre and Jenny. Is it Andre DeLuke?
I apologize to the committee for running over. We had an overly ambitious agenda today.
Problem. Chair, vice chairs, members of the committee, my name's Andre LeDuc. I'm the Associate Vice President for Safety and Risk Services at the University of Oregon and the Chief Resilience Officer. I'm here to talk about House Bill 3276 in support of that bill. As you all know, the University of Oregon went through a meningitis outbreak back in 2015 and 16. Meningitis B outbreaks on campuses have been happening across the country. Unfortunately, they have landed here in Oregon. And some of the challenges that we face, and not just only addressing an outbreak of this scale, is not just the coordination that it takes to put together mass vaccinations, which we held 4 mass vaccinations over a year's period at our university with 10 then micro vaccinations. It was the coordination between the pharmaceutical companies, the FDA requirements, and the insurance industries that really proved to be one of the largest challenges that we had to face. In February 15 of 2015, we were given a joint recommendation by the CDC, the State Public Health, and County Public Health to vaccinate 22,000 students on our campus. This time happened at a time that the vaccine had just recently been approved, but it had yet not been widely opened up into the market, nor had it really been on the rolls of any of the insurance companies. And so those really created some challenges for us. The University of Oregon does not bill directly to insurance, and so that also presented a challenge. What we chose to do was we wanted to remove all barriers we could for our students, and so we partnered with Safeway, Albertsons, Walgreens, and Pfizer, the maker of Trememba, to basically be our turnkey operation where they were able to do our mass vaccination clinics on our campus, but also that they served to do all of the billing and all the reconciliation. And then the bottom line was we wanted a safety net for our students. I believe you heard from Representative Nathanson this morning that we turned no student away that wanted the vaccine. And that was at a cost to both the university and ultimately to the state. Bottom line of what I see this bill doing is, again, when we are in an outbreak status, the last thing that we really want to be navigating, which you've heard a lot today around insurance and healthcare, is insurance and healthcare. We want to be administering the vaccine that can prevent the spread of the outbreak. And the current situation with meningitis B and the way that vaccines are covered or not covered present a lot of problems and challenges, and you're going to hear from my colleague at OSU that we had hoped that because of the newness of the vaccine that this would be fixed. Unfortunately, from what I'm hearing from my colleagues, we still have challenges in the sense when we're in an outbreak status of people not covering the vaccine. I should state that, again, our failure rate as far as payment was about 20% of those that we vaccinated. And some of the key things that, again, I think you heard from Representative Nathanson this morning was where they were covered by insurance, but it had to be with their primary care provider, or they didn't have a pharmacy note on their coverage. And so again, during an outbreak, these things, if the insurance would cover it normally, we would really love to see that during an outbreak that whoever administers the vaccine is then compensated through insurance. And knowing that this bill will only address Oregon, it is a start. But I think it's a start that this isn't something we in Oregon only face, but it's been addressed at, you know, Providence College had this, Princeton. But also UC Santa Clara. So I think we can be a lead in kind of pushing the insurance industry to say during outbreaks is not the time to get into the weeds on what's covered and what's not covered. And I'll suspend my comments at that time and turn it over to my colleague.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Greenlich and Vice Chairs and Committee. My name is Jenny Hoppenreiser. I'm the executive director at the Student Health Services at Oregon State University. I do want to point out that we have a beaver and a duck sitting here in alignment. So take note of that. It happens. Right. I'm here to support.
It's a non-conference meeting. Huh?
Yes. No civil war between us right here. I am here in support of House Bill 3276 with a -1 amendment. I'm primarily speaking today about the experience as a, kind of a follow-up. We are a real-time lab for this House bill right now at Oregon State, following our colleagues to the south. We are in an outbreak situation with meningococcal B. I also want to call out my colleagues. We have 17 college and university health services across the state, and that serves around 138,500 college students around Oregon. So this is the work that we have to do to protect these individuals. This legislation is timely, and it's extremely important. As we can attest, it's not a matter of if this happens again, but when it happens again. So we're really here to clear these barriers. As leadership for the student health services on colleges and universities, we take this very seriously. You can imagine the responsibility of overseeing the health and well-being of our college students. So this is our purpose. This is our mission. This is why we're here. We're here to protect our students. Now, leading these the health services in the midst of this outbreak has been quite an event. We learned a lot from U of O. We're here to learn from each other and share knowledge. So we're here to provide these essential protective vaccinations and at the same time protect our students from these financial burdens. Student health services are optimally placed to deliver this care in a very timely, student-centric manner. And I don't have to tell you that students are really burdened now with the cost of education. Any kind of financial impact on these students will have an impact. They're also busier than they have ever been before. Their jobs, work, family, many, many. So it's having the student-centric approach is really critical in our job, which is to get as many students vaccinated as possible. So along with the County Health Board and the Oregon Health Authority, we declared the outbreak at Oregon State in February. This was following two cases last winter term. The first two cases were in November, December. Thankfully, these students have recovered. Thankfully, they have recovered. We organized two mass vaccination clinics early March. And our aim is to get 7,000 of those that we deem to be most at risk in the door and immunized. That's our purpose. We will be holding two more clinics mid-April. We're planning those right now. As our colleagues are saying, this MenB vaccine is now approved by the CDC for individuals who are at risk in an outbreak situation. So it is a covered benefit. It's not covered necessarily if given by an out-of-network provider. So we have the exact same issues. For our clinics, we did due diligence. We brought in pharmacists that were in network with the larger plans in Oregon. We contacted as many people as we possibly could beforehand. However, in spite of this, and I wish I had a little video of this, the individual attention, you can imagine all of these students with all their individual plans and the need to manage networks for all of these individual plans, it just bogged the system. We had students waiting 90 minutes or more to get a vaccine, only to learn that it would not be covered by their insurance or their CCO for that matter. So we had students leaving or opting to get the vaccine anyway and pay for it out of pocket. So we're continuing our work to into the foreseeable future. So this is real time. We need this bill now. We have to manage our staff time and all the work that they're doing to try to clear these many barriers piecemeal, one by one. It's just not sustainable. House Bill 3276 in this Dash 1 amendment would clear these barriers for us. It would resolve most of these issues for us. And I also want to point out, just as by way of thanks, our partners at Oregon Health Authority and the Benton County Health Department, but we had private insurance companies that did step up. We had CCOs that did step up in the midst of this and assure us that they would make sure these claims were paid for their students, so we know it is possible. So with that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We're going to carry over this public hearing to Monday. There are two people who can't come back who would like to be acknowledged as supporting it. Would you put that on the record?
Sure. Bruce Thompson of Benton County Health Department and Charlie Fawn
Felton
of the Coalition of the Local Health Offices.
I'm very excited. You can be, oh, good. Okay, well, we're going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3276. We're going to reschedule, not carry over, but reschedule the work sessions on 2301 and 2664, and I apologize to my committee. I appreciate you being so patient. We are adjourned. We are adjourned. Appreciate you being so patient.